Hello, and welcome to the Classicist Podcast from the Hoover Institution. I'm Troy Sinek, here with Victor Davis Hanson, the Martin and Ilya Anderson Senior Fellow at the Hoover Institution. And Victor, we turn for today's show to Turkey and its relationship to the United States. This, of course, precipitated by the recent announcement from the Trump administration that the United States was going to draw down its presence in parts of northern Syria, where there were Kurdish populations that helped us in the fight against the Islamic State. And the fear has been all along that in the absence of an American presence there, Turkey, which has longstanding tensions with the Kurds, partially because Kurdish separatism is perceived as a threat to Ankara, was going to pour in and overwhelm or even slaughter the Kurds. So before we even get into the deeper context, the reaction to the Trump administration's decision ran the gamut from total moral outrage from people who said that we were selling the Kurds out and it was unconscionable to people saying, look, what's the American national security interest in us holding the line in this feud halfway around the world? What was your reaction?
Well, my reaction was that everyone was reducing this to Kurds, good, and what we did is bad. But there's Kurds and there's Kurds. There's Kurds, the largest population, I think 27% of them are in Turkey. And there's Syrian Kurds, there's Iranian Kurds, and there's Iraqi Kurds. And we tend to be allied with the Iraqi Kurds and the Syrian Kurds, but we understand that the Syrian Kurds are a bit different in that they support and aid the Turkish Kurds, which are who are perfectly capable of using terrorism to achieve their political ends. So that was the first thing you have to keep in mind, that yes, they were friends with us, but it was for their benefit as much as ours, and they did things that we weren't comfortable with. Then, as I said earlier, the problem was that Turkey, by all standards of NATO, shouldn't be any longer a NATO ally. It's the only dictatorial country. It's a democracy only in name in the alliance now. It just bought the S-400 Soviet missile system, anti-aircraft missile system, whose components may be enriched by the fact that Turkey has seven or eight companies that are assembling parts for the F-35, and that expertise may find its way into that system, which would be devastating for NATO because that's going to be its prime signature fighter. In addition to that, it flies 70 or 80 times a month into Greek airspace. It bullies Greek boats in the Dodecanese Islands. And the Turkish Cypriot problem is roughly an example of Turkish aggression, and it has no support worldwide. And then we add all of this into the equation that Turkey's friends are usually our enemies, whether Russia or Syria or Iran, and its enemies are usually our friends, whether that's Israel or Egypt or Greece. And so that makes it very difficult that we're supposed to come to the aid of Turkey when it's not an ally, and we're supposed to come to the aid of the Kurds when they're friends, but they're not allies. And that's what the problem was. And then the other subsidiary concern was nobody really could tell us how 200 soldiers or 250 in between these two forces were going to serve as a tripwire and what that meant. Did it mean that they were going to die or get attacked and one of their bases was shelled and then we were going to massively intervene? Or did it mean they were symbolic and the Turkish armed forces wouldn't dare even think of attacking them? So we never really got an explanation. And then finally, the whole issue of troops between Kurds and Turks, is that the same as American troops inside Syria? And everybody seemed to think it was. So when Trump said, I'm taking those troops out between those two military forces, they said, oh, he's leaving Syria, but he actually didn't. We still have about 5,000 troops there guarding various oil fields and serving as deterrence in various places. So there's a lot of misinformation surrounding that decision.
You've written a lot lately about how uneasy the U.S. alliance, such as it is, with Turkey is, not just because of the things that have happened in the past few months, but because of some deeper, sort of longer-running issues. And in a recent column, you wrote, not since the U.S. came to the aid of Joseph Stalin's USSR in World War II has America so disliked and so feared a valuable but utterly untenable ally. You mentioned a lot of the factors behind that in your last answer. One thing you didn't mention, which I hear very little about outside of your columns, Victor, is the role that nuclear weapons plays in this uneasy relationship. Explain that dynamic.
And that Insular Air Force Base, which is one of our biggest overseas air force base, has about 50 of these M60 or something atomic bombs. They're kind of an obsolete bomb. They're one of those the Cold War later manifestations of nuclear weapons whose kiloton each can be adjusted. I think it can range from somewhere from 20 all the way up to 200 kilotons. If you have 50 of them, in theory, you might have 250 Hiroshimas or Nagasakis, and they're stored in silos at this base. And that base, as we learned during the Cypriot crisis of 1974, was not tenable. We had to leave a lot of our installations there. And then during the so-called Turkish coup of a few years ago, 2016, the last year of the Obama administration, the power was cut off to that base. And then when you add into this bad equation that Erdogan has said in the past that arbitrarily removal of those weapons would force Turkey to go nuclear. In other words, it's, as I said in the column, it's trying to say that ownership of nuclear weapons or the possession of nuclear weapons on your own soil is tantamount to ownership. And so people have said to me, well, that's not true. We can, in the middle of the night, we could send teams in there and just take out the cores and dismantle them. But I think that we report so regularly to our Turkish counterparts, they would know what was up. And the fact that these are sort of fossilized weapons and they're not new generation nuclear weapons, and nobody quite knows who the target of these weapons would be, lends the impression that they're there basically to reassure Turkey that it doesn't have to go nuclear, that a NATO ally has provided de facto nuclear deterrence for it, which might have been a good idea 20 years ago, but I don't think it's a very good idea when you have an Islamicist government that is basically an enemy of the United States in many ways.
Well, to that point about having an Islamist government, it's probably worth rewinding the tape a little bit on the last century or so of Turkish history, going back to when the country was emerging from the ruins of the Ottoman Empire. Turkey under Erdogan, who's been president for 5 years and was prime minister for over a decade before that, is a country that's on a significantly different trajectory than it was on before. Can you guys give us a sense of who he is and how he's changed that equation?
Well, he's an Islamicist, and while there was a democracy in name, it was the power behind most political leaders was a secularized military that had been trained by the United States and was very loyal to the United States, and had their role vis-a-vis the Mediterranean, rivalries with Israel or friendships with Israel or Greek relate was all always adjudicated by military proconsuls. But Erdogan came along and he said, you know, basically there's a veneer along the coast. It's a big veneer of Turkey's population from Istanbul all the way down to Anatolia. But that's not the real Turkish citizen. The real Turkish citizen is in the inland, the heartland, the rural small towns, farming communities of Anatolia, the Ankara population. And they are increasingly fundamentalist, and they are supportive of Sunni Islamic radicalism. And I'm going to channel that new fervor into a neo-Ottoman vision. And that neo-Ottoman vision says it can be very trivial. It can be existential. It can say, you know what, we're not going to have any more Armenian or Greek Orthodox churches open in our cities, and they've closed down a great number. Or we can say that we're going to turn Hagia Sophia back from a museum into a mosque, which they claim they're thinking about. Or it can mean that we're going to not insist on secular literature, freedom of speech, or even in matters of fashion, we're going to more resemble an Arab country than we are a Western country. And part of this was anger about not being let into the European Union. Part of it was the leverage they had over Europe because they have about 2 million refugees and they're getting paid $4 or $5 billion $1 billion a year by the Europeans to house them, and they've threatened to unleash them into Europe. But whatever exegesis we use, it's pretty clear that Erdogan doesn't see his future as a secularized Western liberal leader eager to, you know, regularize his country along, normalize his country along EU standards and make it part of the EU, or even in the military sense, to become the old ally again that it once was to the United States.
You said earlier in the show that Turkey doesn't really belong in NATO anymore. As a strategic matter right now, is the greater risk in keeping them in or in pushing them out and perhaps closer to some of those unsavory powers that you mentioned earlier?
Yeah, I think that's the only argument. When I said it doesn't really, I didn't say it doesn't matter. It doesn't really matter. And by that I meant in a perfect world, we would get rid of it in a minute. But it's not a perfect world. And the problem is it has, after the United States, the largest army in the alliance, 650,000 troops. And they're known as pretty good fighters. And it's got some advanced technology. So we're thinking in this cauldron of the Middle East, the main land power there that borders Syria and is close to a lot of places where we've intervened in the past is Turkey. And if we don't have some influence with that military, whether by stationing troops there or training its officers in the United States or having liaisons there, then that huge force can be used against our allies and interests and it can align itself with Iran or Syria or Russia or China. So I guess the default position has been, do you want a bad ally or a good enemy? And I think we'd rather have a bad ally than a scary or an enemy that's quite potent.
So final question. Along those lines, one of the things, of course, that has kept the U.S.-Turkey relationship together, even through these hardships, is the sense that Turkey is too important to our access to and our ability to project power into the Middle East. Is the cost-benefit calculation there the same as it was? Are our interests as intense in the Middle East as they were a decade or two ago?
I don't think they are. I know that the Mediterranean in general and the Middle East in particular, because of its geography among three different continents, et cetera, is always considered critical. But there's two or three considerations that made it critical, made it, the Mediterranean and Turkey in particular, critical, I don't think are necessarily factors anymore. And by that I mean, one is oil. We're not dependent on Middle East oil anymore. We're the largest gas and oil producer in the world. I think next year we become the largest exporter of gas and oil. And then second, there's no longer an Israel versus the Sunni dichotomy that made it very difficult to adjudicate between our supposed friends. The Sunni monarchies are much more afraid of Iran and maybe their surrogates like Hamas or Hezbollah than they are of Israel. And so, and then third, Israel in relative terms, economically, in energy, and its military is far more powerful than its neighbors than it's ever been. So I think there's a sense that we don't really need the Middle East in general, and therefore not Turkey as much as we did in the past. If you can just think of a scenario under this Trump doctrine, if a Chinese freighter was attacked in the Straits of Hormuz or it was closed to the Straits of Hormuz, in theory, in the old calculus, that would be a disaster demanding a United States response. But Trump would probably say, well, you know, they have a $600 billion surplus with us and it's their problem. And they're the biggest exporter of goods and services to the Middle East now and the biggest importer of its oil. Let them take care of it. Or even if it was a European country, the United States would say, well, they're in NATO, but on the other hand, they don't want to defend themselves. They don't make the 2%. They want to trade with our enemies. They undermine us on the Iranian sanctions. So let them take care of it. I think that's where we're going now with the Middle East. I don't know if it's necessarily positive or dangerous, but I think that's where we're going. And the old argument was, well, we need their oil, but more importantly, the world needs their oil. And I think people are saying, no, the world doesn't need their oil. China needs their oil. And to a lesser extent, some of the countries in Europe that are very critical of the United States. So I don't think we're going to intervene as easily as we did in the past. And this is all superimposed on our past interventions, whether it was Reagan in 83 in the Bekaa Valley, or Reagan bombing Libya in 86, or Clinton doing it in 2011, or going into Afghanistan in 2001, or going into Iraq in 2003, and earlier going in there in 1990-91. I think everybody says in all of those scenarios, we've had a very difficult time translating clear tactical success on the ground to long-term strategic advantage. And so when a president says, I just don't like that area anymore, I just don't think that when we fight on our terms, or we don't really know who's good and bad, or we don't know how to make it all in a cost-benefit analysis work for us, and you know what, I don't think it's that critical to us anymore. That's a increasingly persuasive argument.
You've been listening to the Classicist Podcast with Victor Davis Hanson. Remember, you can read all of Victor's work at victorhanson.com, and you can follow him on Twitter at VDHanson. And if you enjoy the show, please rate it on iTunes or wherever you get your podcasts. For Victor Davis Hanson, I'm Troy Senek. Thanks for listening.
This podcast has been a production of the Hoover Institution. For more information about our work, please visit hoover.org.